Today we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Taylor Marshall, author of the best-selling and much-talked-about new book, Infiltration, The Plot to Destroy the Church from Within. We will spend today's show discussing some of the central ideas and key themes present in this book, which is now available for purchase on Amazon and Sophia Institute Press. We have included these links in the description of our video podcast. Dr. Marshall is a best-selling author whose works also include Thomas Aquinas in 50 Pages and the Sword and Serpent fiction books, as well as a number of other works. He is the founder of the New St. Thomas Institute and host of the Taylor Marshall Show podcast. Dr. Marshall, it's a pleasure to have you on today. Welcome back to the Right on Point podcast.
It's good to be back with you guys.
So before we get into a discussion about the book, I just want to note a quick disclaimer to our audiences. We'll be discussing a number of key ideas mentioned in the Infiltration book, so if you haven't already purchased or read the book, please do so before listening to this podcast to avoid spoiling many of the main topics discussed, although there have already been many videos on YouTube discussing this book, interviews with Dr. Marshall, so on and so forth. But I wanted to begin by getting your take on two incidents that happened on Twitter over the past week. Bishop Thomas Joseph Tobin of Providence, Rhode Island, was recently chastised by leftist social media zealots for having the audacity to say so-called Pride Month events promote a culture and encourage activities that are contrary to Catholic faith and morals, adding they are especially harmful to children. A few days later, Father Kevin Cusick, an outspoken traditionalist priest, took it upon himself to suspend his Twitter account after a similar incident occurred, in which he asked a woman to please help the priest to protect the purity of men at Holy Mass by choosing to dress modestly. He too was deeply criticized by the social justice mob for his comments. I want to get your take on both of these incidents, and how should Catholics respond to future incidents like this, which are seemingly becoming increasingly more and more as we head into this age of social media and leftist censorship of conservative voices.
Yeah, we need to follow these closely. The Bishop Tobin, and this is Bishop Tobin of Rhode Island. This is not Cardinal Tobin right. of Newark. Some people people confuse these. So Bishop Tobin rightfully stated that the Pride gatherings are not a place for children, etc. And the response was a tsunami of hatred and antagonism and really Catholic bigotry. I could only read so many of the comments on that tweet before just, you know, just turning it off. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, just can't look at it. And so I got on Twitter and said, everybody needs to rally and support Bishop Tobin in this moment. This is a moment of a bishop having bravery, having a spine, standing up for the truth, and instructing his flock on what to do. And he's being slammed. And two things happen from this that I think we as Catholics can learn from. The first is very few. I counted three bishops that came out explicitly supporting their brother, Bishop Tobin. The other 200-something Catholic American bishops did nothing. In fact, many of them are hosting Pride events in their own diocese or approving of them. That's the first thing. So we know that the majority of the bishops don't have Bishop Tobin's back. That's a hard thing for a bishop, right?
Yeah.
Right.
The second thing is he did put out a statement, which I did not favor, I didn't like, saying that he regretted that this offended people and he wished, you know, he hoped that the event would be a positive and productive event. And, you know, in a sense, that just, it's not a complete walk back, but in a sense, that tells the liberal left that they're winning.
Yeah.
It hurts all of us. Mm-hmm. It hurts all of us. It tells them if you do enough mean tweets, we will back down, even a bishop. Mm-hmm. So that was a loss for our side. And then with Father Cusick, I followed that one as well. And as soon as I saw it, I said, oh boy, this is going to be a big, big problem, right? Because the feminists are not going to like this one bit. And from what Twitter has said and other people have said, he wasn't banned or blocked by Twitter, but he did, as you stated, and it's not clear if he closed his account down or deleted the tweets. I haven't quite figured out exactly, but his account is basically deactivated. of his own initiative. And again, I wish he would have stayed firm, but I understand. I mean, we live in a very toxic environment, not just in the West and in America, but within the church.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are bishops who are going to these traditional, strong Orthodox priests and saying, you are going to do this on social media. I'm not saying this happened, people. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying these things can and do happen in the Catholic Church. Or you're going to be suspended. Mm-hmm. Or you're going to have to go to a go seek therapy. Right? And if you're a priest, you know, you can't just say, okay, well, I quit. I'm going to go work in Lincoln, Nebraska. Right? You're kind of stuck with your diocese and with your bishop. And so a lot of these great holy priests who are trying to stand up for Christ, stand up for orthodoxy, stand up for the church and the traditions of our church and the liturgy are not just being slammed by the public like we saw on Twitter. They're even having pressure exerted upon them by their fathers in Christ, who is the bishop. Mm-hmm. So these are things that we're now seeing as lay Catholics, and we need to observe them. We need to pray, and we need to realize that the fight is not just out there. No, the fight is within. In fact, the greatest enemies to Christ right now, I would argue, are not, you know, Freemasons or atheists on chat rooms right now. The greatest enemies right now are in the church. They have infiltrated. We are in an infiltration, and we all need to wake up and realize we have been infiltrated. Absolutely. We're surrounded.
And I think that's an excellent segue into our first question about the book, but I just wanted to add that, you know, Father Cusick was really just known among Catholic circles on the internet. I mean, he's fairly obscure to the mainstream media. Now, all of a sudden, he's on Yahoo News, the front page, because of these feminists trying to censor him. I like what Tucker Carlson did a few months ago when he was also subject to an attack by Media Matters, which is a left-wing group that delves into your history and tries to uncover things that go against the prevailing zeitgeist or whatever. And Tucker just basically told them off, saying, you know, I'm not going to apologize for these comments I made. That's, you know, they may have been dumb, but I stand by them and whatever. And I think exactly that's the approach that conservatives need to do to avoid providing fuel for the leftist mob, because I also concedes what I think you said. You know, it concedes like they're correct, you're in the wrong. So I 100% agree with you on that. But moving now on to the book, I wanted to ask about the writing and research process that went into producing this book. I know you discussed this with Mr. Gordon on your TNT show last week, but I know you mentioned working for several hours each day in a coffee shop. I just wanted to ask, what were the resources like? What resources did you use to do your research? Did you outline the work? What was your writing process like? I think it'd be interesting to know how that played out.
Yeah, so this book is theological, but it's also historical and in a way kind of journalistic.
Yeah.
Right. By which I mean putting together a meta narrative, a story, an account mm-hmm. of what happened. And in this case, it's it goes back to 1840.
Yeah.
So, you know, coming up on 200 years of history. So it takes the historical facts that we have going back to, say, Our Lady of La Salette and the permanent instruction of Alta Vendita and secret societies after the French Revolution. So that puts us in the beginning of the 1800s. And then it follows Our Lady of La Salette, the vision of the loss of the Papal States, the vision of Leo XIII, the St. Michael prayer, brings us up to, St. Pius X, the war against modernism, and then just sort of a slow, steady erosion of Catholic orthodoxy leading up to the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And so my book is providing the resources and the research to show that, you know, where we are right now in our current crisis didn't happen just because of the Pope. Mm-hmm. It didn't just happen because Benedict XVI resigned. It didn't just happen because Vatican II.
Yeah.
This has been a long, slow, steady battle by the enemies of Jesus Christ. And they knew They said in the 1840s this would be a century-long battle to take this ground, and they've taken it. I mean, you go back and you read what they write in the 1800s, and you look around, and you look at what, you know, Pope Gregory and Pius IX and Leo XIII and Pope Pius X, everything they were warning us about, we are living in it right now. And it was done on purpose. It's not an accident of history. It was infiltrated. So in order to do that, I had to bring together the historical resources. Everything's footnoted. And where things are uncertain, I tell you they're uncertain in the book, in Infiltration. And then also kind of bringing together the approved Marian apparitions, the citations, the quotes, and just, you know, gathering them all in a tray, sorting them all, getting out the string, and just putting together a pearl necklace, you know, just a pearl, pearl, mm-hmm. a pearl, and putting them in order and then just sourcing them all. So when you read it, you're like, that's crazy. That could never happen. You look down, there's a footnote. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's where it happened.
Yep.
It did happen. Or the Pope never said that. Pope Paul VI never said that. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's the footnote. Oh, he did say that.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, because there's a lot of, especially in literature that's critical of the church from within the church. So you could think of like traditionalists or maybe Sede Vacantis websites, mm-hmm. things like that. There's a lot of info out there, and sometimes there's private revelations and all that, and it's hard to source what's legit and what's speculation, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a bias. If you want this to be true, you're going to gather as many sources as you can. And honestly, there's a lot of things that I would have liked to put in the book, but I felt I can't really source this. It seems apocryphal. I need to let people know it is apocryphal, or just leave it out. Right. So I didn't want them going through the book and having kind of a 40%. I'm not so sure about this. I wanted them chapter by chapter feeling confident about what's being asserted and what the story is. What is the infiltration?
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to ask, what inspired you to write this book now? I know you said that you wouldn't have been able to produce this book maybe 2 years ago, maybe even last year. Was it Vigano, McCarrick? Did these events prove as a source of inspiration? Has this been long in development? What was the source of inspiration for releasing this now in 2019?
I'd say the source of it is the resignation of Benedict XVI and the mm-hmm. pontificate of Pope Francis. These are two things that are still rocking us in the Catholic Church today. And I don't care who you are. If you say it's not, you're oblivious. You're not tapped in to Catholics in the pews and to priests and what's going on in the church. There is so much controversy. When we look to Rome and we see Pope Benedict still alive wearing that white cassock, mm-hmm. and we see Pope Francis and all the scandals, both financial and sexual, going along, it just makes your head spin. Yeah. And like I said, there's a lot of, in the back of the book, I say there's a lot of easy options. You know, you can just reject Christianity. You can say, well, I'm going to become Eastern Orthodoxy. The Orthodox are right. Catholicism, the popes have always been kind of messed up. We don't need them.
Yeah.
Eastern Orthodox. You can become Protestant and say, I want my Bible and I want Jesus. And that, forget the church. Mm-hmm. Forget all these sacraments and priests. I'm done with that. You can become a Sede Vacantis and say, hey, in 1958, the lights went out on the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. There's right. no more Pope.
Right.
There's no more cardinals. Mm-hmm. We kind of have this catacomb structure of the Catholic Church. And that's, you know, now we don't have to deal with Benedict XVI or John Paul II or John Paul I, Paul VI, John the 23rd, just flush it all. you can become what they call a Benny Plenist or a resignationist and say, yeah. Benedict the 16th is somehow still the Pope. His resignation wasn't valid. The conclave that elected Francis was tampered with was invalid. All of those options are on the table, but my book, Infiltration, says no to all those options, and I explain why at the very end. This is the last chapter, mm-hmm. Or the second to last. And the proper approach to this is the recognize and resist position. You recognize the Pope. You recognize the Church of Rome. You recognize the institutional structure and the rotten bishops and the scandals, and you say, it's still Christ Church. I am going to resist all of these errors, all of these crimes, all of these immoralities. but I'm going to be faithful, respectful, filial in my love for the church, and I'm going to fight.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm going to fight to the very death, to martyrdom if necessary, because I want a church, and the inspiration for it is I want a church for my children and my grandchildren where they can love Jesus. They don't have to worry about predator priests. Mm-hmm. They don't have to worry about heretical sermons. They don't have to worry about hearing garbage in the confessional.
Yep.
Or garbage from Rome. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is what we're fighting for. And it's a great time to be Catholic. It is unnerving. I think as you read through Infiltration, a lot of the responses that I've heard from the reviewers and people who have read it and are writing me saying, man, every chapter I was just getting more and more like my jaw was falling further and further from my mouth.
Yeah, and I want to ask you more discouragement. About this topic specifically, not to cut you off there. Have the responses changed your perspective at all since the book's release? And has visiting and meeting Pope Francis at all changed your perspective? If you were writing a book today, I'm sure there's a lot of research sort of left on the table that wasn't included in the book and a lot of inspiration there. If you wanted to amend the book or include more, what was the biggest surprise that you learned since the book has been published?
The biggest surprise is just the demand for it. We knew it would be popular, and there, you know, people were asking about it and wanting to get copies. Tons of people wanted to review it ahead of time. So we knew that people were excited and interested in the book. But I mean, the book has been essentially sold out at Amazon. There's a month wait on it right now, and there's more books. We're already into our second printing within the first 4 or 5 days of the book. Everyone, I don't even have a copy. This is what I've got right now, just for review, for interviews. But my surprise is how many people have come behind the book. There have been a few critics. Most of those have been ad hominem attacks against me or against Sophia Press.
Right.
But most of the people who have read the book have been surprised on how well sourced it is and how charitable it is. It's not a hit piece. The thing that's kind of given me a lot of hope on it is how many people from mainstream Catholicism, not, you know, traditionalists, mm-hmm. you know, not, you know, people who kind of have followed these debates for decades, you know, or people who are, you know, already love the Latin Mass or, you know, maybe given a thorough study of the Second Vatican Council or modernism or any of these topics, these Marian apparitions and the Third Secret. But just your mainstream Novus Ordo, Sunday-going Catholic, they're buying this book and they're being introduced to this great conversation of what has happened to our church. Because everybody, like going back to the beginning, everybody knows something's wrong right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody knows it. And no one really knows why it happened, when it happened. And so people have just rallied to this book because it gives them a bird's eye view, right? It's mm-hmm. And it's not just like a really cheap, easy one. Like, well, if Benedict hadn't resigned, things would be fine. Mm-hmm. No, right. it's much bigger than that. If we just hadn't had Vatican II, things would be fine. No, it's bigger than that. It is a big infiltration of demonic proportion. The opening of the book explains how this is a theological and demonic situation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So now I wanted to just, I mean, you speak at length about the book, about how the communist infiltration had occurred throughout as one of the main sources of infiltration into the Catholic Church, both from within the priesthood, as told by Bella Dodd, as well as the communist roots of the St. Gallen Mafia in Switzerland. I was wondering if you had come across in your research the great influence that the Marxists had, particularly over the Jesuit-led liberation theology movement. I'll provide some background for the listeners. This was spearheaded in Latin America following Vatican II, and had been perceived then as a testing ground for this movement going forward. It's remarkable how effective these Jesuits, led by Pedro Arrupe, had been in inculcating this entire largely Catholic population with the idea that liberation theology, you know, people of God, Marxist mentality is correct. This seems also undoubtedly an infiltration by the Marxists and was manifested in Pope John Paul II's visit to Latin America, where during his hour-long homily in Nicaragua in 1983, he was met by the Jesuit-supported Sandinista protesters refusing to allow him to continue on with the mass. Now, Malachi Martin, I know you're a little skeptical of him, but he does write about this event and the corruption of the Jesuit order in particular in the Jesuits, and I do think it fits well with your premise, especially because Pedro Arrupe and then Father Bergoglio had a very good and close relationship, and Bergoglio saw him as a spiritual father, you know, this leader of the Marxist insurrection against the hierarchy, according to the Catholic News Agency. And I was wondering if you considered the transformation of the Jesuit order in your research into what ultimately we are seeing today.
Yeah, it's especially important since we currently are under the first Jesuit pope ever, and he derives from South America and the hotbed of liberation theology. His history with liberation theology is crisscrossed and difficult to follow and understand.
Right.
He seems to be influenced by it, but also at times critical of it. I have, in other places, like on the podcast on YouTube, have talked about with Tim Gordon about, you know, the example of his Peronism and, you know, basically shape shifting depending on the audience. And the Jesuits are important. I do think Malachi Martin has a special insight to them, having been one himself. I focus primarily on the infiltration of the church at large, and especially the priesthood and the seminaries and the religious life. I do talk some about the Jesuits and give some stats on the Jesuits about their downfall.
Right.
But I want to be careful on that, because I think in some circles, everybody kind of has their pet infiltration idea. Like, it was just the communists, you know, it was just the Jews. It was just the Jesuits. You know, they have like their favorite whipping boy. And what I'm saying is
over all of these.
Yeah.
Groups.
They have their favorite.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is, you know, much smarter than any liberation theologian or communist or whatever, is the Luciferian satanic mind of the demons.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Our true, St. Paul says our true enemies are not flesh and blood, but the demonic, the dark principalities. And they're able to inspire and scheme and coordinate things beyond what we could ever understand. This is why it's so important that we have a supernatural outlook, that we love Jesus Christ, that we love Our Lady, that we pray the rosary, that we, you know, follow the traditional forms of Catholic piety. All of these things are, we aren't smart enough to do dialogue and battle with these demonic beings, right? So we have to go and trust in Christ and grace and the supernatural and sacramental to overcome it, or we're going to lose every time. So yeah, I think there is definitely the liberation theology is just socialism repackaged as Christianity. I talk about that at length in Infiltration. There's different versions of it. Liberation theology is one of them. It's adapted politically to South American realities, but you see the same thing happening in Germany, right? They don't really call it liberation theology, but they're still co-opting communism and using it in the German Catholic Church. So it's happening in Italy too. So it's one example. It's geographic, and it is covered in the book, but I don't give particular attention to just the South American and Jesuit phenomenon as a standalone situation.
Right. And I think you do a great job at really showing how this is, and the infiltration is really the orchestrated by Satan's demons just under the guise of modernism, Marxism, and Freemasonry. You do point that out, and I wrote that in my review as well. Now, I do want to give you the opportunity to react to some of the most prominent criticisms of infiltration. Granted, a book of this magnitude with all that it entails and uncovers is inevitably going to face negative reactions. sections, but some single down on the similar theme. They render the premise of the book as conspiracy and argue that the present state of the church should not be attributed to anything more than just humanity's sinfulness. Now, what would you say to those who find it difficult to accept your book's thesis, especially when it comes to the precise connections you make from the fall of the Papal States through Vatican II until St. Gallen Mafia, now where we are today?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some who say the church has always been bad. No big deal. Been there, done that. You know, this is just what it means to be a Catholic, just compromised people, scandals, and all that. It's true. I mean, you know, you go back even to Judas Iscariot and you trace the line all the way up into our very time, and there have always been scandals and crises and betrayers and infiltrations, of course. However, the difference for our current situation and the infiltration that I trace out in this book is that we have, okay, let me back up. From the apostles and Diocletian all the way up until the French Revolution, even Napoleon, the strategy has always been to attack the church from the outside, right? Yeah. To cut off parts, even with Henry VIII, right? To remove and cut off.
Right.
So, or, you know, that's a really holy pope, kill him. Mm-hmm. And then we take his martyrs. I mean, we take his relics, we make him a martyr, mm-hmm. build an altar, build a basilica, and we venerate him as a saint, right? So over time, especially as the French Revolution happened, and then they reverted back and rejected the French Revolution, those Freemasonic, and if that word freaks you out, secular humanist goals were rejected in an overt, violent revolution. And so there was a new strategy in the 1800s, and that was we can't attack the most powerful moral voice in the universe from without. We can't keep kidnapping the Pope, killing the saints, killing the bishops, can't take nuns to the guillotine like they did in the French Revolution.
Yeah.
We will attack it from within. Mm-hmm. And so we have papal documents. We have Marian apparitions. We have Pope Leo XIII creating and adding the St. Michael prayer to the end of every single low mass to be recited throughout the entire world, right? As a exorcism and a resistance against a vision that he saw, which I explain in the book, of demons coming and centering on the city of Rome. So we have a lot of supernatural phenomena that are happening. And we have all these warnings from the popes of an infiltration. I give the papal documents. I give the papal quotes. Pius IX and Leo XIII are talking about these conspiracies. They use the word conspiracies. I should give you the quotes. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I, as a third millennium man, am taking the idea of conspiracy and then just sort of casting it over history. No, I'm going to the voices of the clerics, the bishops, the popes, living in the voice of the Blessed Virgin Mary in these times and showing, no, they are talking, they are aware of a infiltration, a conspiracy within the church. And it's repeated decade after decade. Mm-hmm. When it stops being repeated, by the way, is around the 1960s. Everybody suddenly forgets.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the problem. That's when it was on parade at that point.
We thank you for joining us today on Right on Point. Before we continue with the second half of our show, we hope we've sparked your interest to visit our website, rightonpointpodcast.com, where you can listen to previous episodes and interviews, contact us, and learn more about the program. As you scroll down our homepage, please consider making a contribution to our show. There are options to either make a one-time payment or to become a monthly donor through Patreon or PayPal. Both options are equally appreciated. Even a small one-time contribution goes a long way. Right on Point runs exclusively off of your generosity. Each payment helps our podcast remain on all your favorite platforms, wherever podcasts can be found, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and many more. And as we increasingly integrate more video into your Right on Point experience on YouTube, viewers will be able to see up close and personal our spectacular and unrivaled guest lineup, which includes some of the most influential names in politics today. Lastly, please subscribe to Right on Point on the platform you are currently listening to us so that you never miss an episode. We especially appreciate new subscribers on YouTube and iTunes. Thank you again for all of your support. We are absolutely committed to delivering our growing and devoted fan base the best experience possible. And now on to the second half of our show. This question feeds right into that. You've spoken a lot how one of the goals of Infiltration was, of course, to debunk the idea that a single historical event, which is typically claimed to be the Second Vatican Council, was responsible for the decline of the Catholic Church. Your argument is that the timeline spans much further back in history, going back at least to the 19th century and probably further back still. Nevertheless, the corruption became especially noticeable over the past 50 years or so. To that end, you recount several pivotal moments in papal history since Vatican II that expedited this process. Many people target Pope Francis today as embodying the spirit of Vatican II more than any other pope. Others point to the papacy of Pope John XXIII, who initiated Vatican II by desiring to throw open the windows of the church. What I found most fascinating in your narrative, however, is the corruption that plagued Pope Paul VI in particular. You describe the pope as being very close to unsavory characters like Saul Alinsky, the communist community organizer whose work, Rules for Radicals, is dedicated to Lucifer. Paul VI was also friends for decades with Michele Sidona. This is something I did not know beforehand, a notorious mafioso and Freemason. I want you to talk a little bit more about this. What shocked you most about researching Paul VI's papacy, which seemed to be mired in controversy and scandal from beginning to the end, and precipitating the financial scandals that plagued the Vatican Bank in the late 1970s.
So, yeah, I mean, I'll begin with Saul Alinsky because I think most Americans are familiar with Alinsky and Alinsky tactics.
Yeah,
he's a great influencer for the current Democratic Party and the leftist political forces in America, highly influential in the Clintons, Barack Obama as well. They see him as sort of a founder for the way that they have executed their political platform, which has been pretty successful. Saul Alinsky was one who was an infiltrator. He was not an overt, radical, violent communist. He was a quiet, polite, and careful communist who did community organizing, mm-hmm. which is a way of, you could call it community infiltrating. And he wrote a lot of books about this. As you mentioned, he dedicated his book, Rules for Radicals, to Lucifer, the first rebel. And what's most alarming is that Cardinal Montini, who became Pope Paul VI and closed the Second Vatican Council, he was a friend of Alinsky. In fact, they had three meetings. We also know that Montini read his books. He was connected to him through the French philosopher Jacques Maritain, who also has some problems as well. He was a major fan of Saul Alinsky. And so we see an influence and a friendship with Montini and Alinsky. When Pius XII died in 1958 and they're going into conclave, Saul Alinsky's on record when he's asked, who do you think will be the next pope? He says, I hope it's Montini. And if it is, all drinks are on me.
Yeah.
So we see that Saul Alinsky was a friend of Montini. He saw him as an ally, and he ultimately wanted him to be a pope. Now, Montini didn't win the election in 58, Roncalli did, and became John XXIII. Mm-hmm. But the next pope was Cardinal Montini, and he became Paul VI, and he sort of wrapped up Vatican II, then made all the liturgical changes from 65 to 1970, initiated the Novus Ordo liturgy, rewrote the liturgy for all seven sacraments. And, he did have Humanae Vitae in 1968, but from 1970 to 1978, you have a enormous bank scandal at the IOR, which is the Vatican Bank. And he brings in one of his old buddies from Milan, Sindona, who you just mentioned, who was, you know, in the pocket of the Sicilian Mafia. What was happening is the Vatican Bank was going to lose its tax exemptions. And so Paul VI brought in his banker buddy, this mafia guy, Sindona, to fix things and to make the Vatican Bank work again,
yeah,
and to help with regulations. And basically what happened, whether Paul VI knew it or not, the Vatican Bank became the premier money laundering bank of the world because Vatican City-State is its own nation, mm-hmm. which makes its bank particularly attractive.
Absolutely.
Right. It's a unique bank that belongs to an independent, tiny city state without transparency to others. And so a deal went down in the 1970s where the Vatican Bank benefited and got to sidestep some regulation, but also got wrapped into a money laundering scheme that cost the Vatican Bank millions of dollars. Yeah. It's all documented in the book, all the numbers, and I explain the numbers and I adjust them to modern day inflation standards so you can see how much money we're talking about here. Sandana himself was arrested in America. He was tried. He was brought back to Italy, faced murder charges. He was poisoned.
Yeah.
Poison ended up in his coffee in prison. He died in prison, poisoned by the mafia, so he wouldn't talk anymore about what was going on. So, yeah, a lot of shady characters and people in the Vatican lost careers, lost lives, and a lot of bankers lost lives as well in that whole shakedown. That was, if you've seen Godfather 3,
have you guys seen it?
Okay, so that's the backdrop. That's the backdrop for that movie. Not that that movie is true, and I'm not endorsing it or saying that that's what happened, but they're using the backdrop of the story I'm explaining to make their own Hollywood version. Of what could have happened.
Coppola, the director of the movie, said in the director's cut or the narrative over that film that, you know, when we were filming this movie in Rome, it was common knowledge on the streets that John Paul I was poisoned. I mean, which kind of goes into our
that goes on to our next question. Coppola said it, and he said it was common knowledge, right? But on a recent interview you had a TNT podcast, you stated that since the book's publication, you're now 100% certain of these events, that they led to the murder of John Paul I. Meanwhile, in the foreword of your book, Bishop Athanasius Schneider even noted that due to the lack of sufficient evidence available from the Vatican archives, some aspects, such as the circumstances surrounding his death, must remain as hypotheses. What made you change your mind from a few months ago? What did you come across that really solidified this idea? And were there any other pieces of information that were surprising that also changed your mind in addition to the supposed murder of John Paul I?
Yeah, the main thing that changed my mind on it was I'd known about the Vatican Bank scandals. I didn't know how deep it was, and I didn't know how much it had been related to Paul the VI.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then also doing a lot of research on Marcinkus and all the different characters and Sindano, because some people say, oh, John Paul I was murdered because he was going to be conservative and he was going to wind back Vatican II, and I never found that convincing. Mm-hmm. But once I found about the money and I found out about how Cardinal Villo and his connection with P2 and with the secret societies in Italy, and also how Villo basically arrived early and cleaned up the scene of John Paul I's death and removed items from the room and looked at the timeline of events and how everything happened with the nuns who were there and with the authorities and with the embalming of the body. The whole thing looks extremely sketchy. And I agree with Athanasius Schneider. It's a hypothesis. I don't think I ever said I was 100% certain, but I am persuaded that that's probably what happened, very much so. But again, it's hard to solve a murder that's, you know, 41 years ago. Right. Is it 41 years ago?
Yeah.
But I think when people read Infiltration, if you understand the banking backdrop and the mob backdrop leading up until 1978, and you see the people who are dying, you realize that the new Pope would be plopped right into the center of that. And he's either going to play ball or not play ball. Yeah. And there are indications that John Paul I was not going to play ball with it.
Right. Wow, that's fascinating, especially because, you know, not many people know about the whole history with the Vatican Bank scandal. And then to read that, and, you know, it's certainly interesting to read. Now, I wanted to go again to some of these critical responses to your conclusion. Some have said that your recognize and resist method of going forward, which we would agree with, but some have stated that this may not be the way to go forward, considering that you have pinpointed these problems within the church and really have dedicated it to these actors, these demonic actors and satanic influences. So how can you still justify this position after your research has concluded that the church of today has been overridden by these people and not really the church of the faithful? To those who might be, you know, apt to become sedes or something.
Right. Yeah, I'd say that the any criticism comes from one of two sides, a left side and a right side. So the left side is the status quo. These are your parish priests who like how things are going. These are the bishops who like how things are going. Your Vatican Curial workers who like how things are going. They don't want to shake it up. Mm-hmm. And they want to just pin it on, oh, McCarrick was a bad guy, or those things have happened in the past. We're taking care of it. Just trust us. Mm-hmm. Wait to the next USCCB meeting. Then we'll fix it. Right? Yeah. That's one approach. And so my book is saying that that's not acceptable. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And so that there's going to be some friction there. Right? So, I mean, if you receive a paycheck from a bishop, yes, you're going to probably be critical of this book, mm-hmm. because it puts your place on unsteady ground. The other side, maybe the, we could call it the right side, would be those who have rejected the current papacy. They reject Pope Francis, either because they're a sede vacantis going back to 1958, or because they're a resignationist and they still believe Benedict is the Pope somehow. And both those camps have been critical of this book as well, because it goes against their thesis. What's kind of interesting about that is my research and my data points are basically the same research and the same data points that we would agree on. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, we would both agree about things regarding the Second Vatican Council. We would both say we agree with Our Lady of La Salette and Fatima, and that we agree on the St. Michael prayer, and we all love St. Pius the 10th, right? So, you know, at the cocktail party, we're all, you know, chinking our glasses and saying cheers. So we agree on all that. But then when you get to the last chapter and it says, no, the institutional church that you see that's so messed up is really the institutional church. Yeah. And Pope Francis really is the Pope. Then they just want to throw the book against the wall, right? Because their conclusion is, we look at all this data, and we now reject it. There's no way Pope Francis could be the Pope. Ergo, he is not the Pope, right? So it's a agreement at the beginning and a disagreement at the end. And I understand that, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you take those positions, you know, you have to be prepared to say that, let's say you're a resignationist, all the cardinals that Francis has appointed are not real cardinals. If you think Benedict's still
right.
And so how do we get to the next?
Yeah, then the churches.
That's messed up.
You can't, right?
or if you say there hasn't been a pope since 1958, that means there are no cardinals. Mm-hmm. How do you elect the next pope? It's been 60 years, folks. That's 61 years coming up this year.
Right.
You know, and then they say, well, the clergy of Rome would elect the pope. Mm-hmm. But then you ask them, well, don't you believe all the clergy of Rome are apostates and heretics and Novus Ordo Catholics, heretics? And they would say, well, yeah. Okay, well, then how can heretics elect the Pope, according to your view? So, you know, there's the argument, and then there's the ripples that move out from that argument.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as someone who loves Christ and loves the church and who is scholarly and academic, I want to look at the whole picture, not just, oh yeah, this argument makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's follow it. But now we can never have a Pope again.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
How do we get out of that? So, yeah, those are the two. One of them wants to keep it as it is, and one of them wants to reject it.
Yeah.
And I'm in the tension in the middle, saying, no, there's a different way. We can win this back. It's not going to happen in a year or 10 years, probably not even in our lifetimes, maybe my kids' lifetimes, but we can win it back. Mm-hmm. And I outline how we could do that at the end of the book. But
absolutely.
Yeah, it's. It means we've got to do a lot of work.
Yeah.
Right.
So you reach the end of the book and you either roll up your sleeves or you give up.
Yeah.
Right. Have we reached rock bottom? Do we go only up from here, or is it going to go?
Okay. It's going to get worse. It's going to get worse in 2019. More things are going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a prophet. I don't know the future, but I imagine the next pontificate will be even bumpier.
Do you think the rise of this is just a quick question, and we're almost done right here. The rise of populism in Europe, in America, signals a potential change in course for the church. I mean, you're seeing really among young people, especially, a rise of traditional Catholicism. I mean, these are pretty much the only Catholics left in the church. And as you said, with your own children, many of them only know the traditional Latin Mass, which is very good. So is there hope in that regard, do you think?
Yeah, I would not want to say a rise in populism, because our political enemies want us to talk like that.
Yeah.
It's really a rise in a realization that the secular, humanist, socialist worldview doesn't work. The Russians already figured that out. But now you're having a generation of young people who feel betrayed. They were promised all these things under Barack Obama. And it's not working at, or name your leftist political prime minister or whatever. They're realizing that they're being sold out. They're realizing that immigration's a bad deal for them. The euro is a bad deal for them. The EU is a bad deal for them. In America, similar things, student debt, all these things are mounting up. And they're looking for an answer to that that is not from the secular left. There is a renewed interest in Catholicism amongst Catholics. There's a huge renewal in the last 6 months to 9 months in traditional Catholicism. It's blowing up.
Yeah,
all over the world. Absolutely. All over the world. Yeah. In America a lot, but also in Europe. You know, it's going great. And they're looking for the transcendental. If they're not interested in Christian or Catholicism, they're turning to people like Jordan Peterson.
Yeah,
who's offering something that's kind of metaphysical.
Yeah,
a meta narrative. Right. So this is what's happening right now, because there is this epiphany that the secularist ideal values are not providing what they promised to them. And they're calling it populism or whatever. But I think what you see going on in Brazil, you see with Salvini in Italy, you see in America with Trump,
Nigel Farage.
It's not Farage. Yeah, it's not always Catholic. It's not always Catholic. But there are similarities there that are patriotic. That are focused on family, traditional values, and a reverence for Christianity.
Absolutely.
In a European patrimony, not being ashamed of it, but saying, no, the European patrimony is good. I rejoice in that. So it is hopeful. It can go off the rails. I'm watching it. I mean, some of these people are going off the rails, right? When you look at some of these pagan or atheistic alt-right groups, they're off the rails.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I don't like that's real. That's not good.
No.
But if it harnesses itself with traditional Catholicism,
absolutely. I mean, that's the
only it's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing. Succeed. I tell you what.
Yeah.
And we need to stop. I want everybody listening to your show. We need to stop saying how the West, Judeo-Christian, Judeo-Christian. We need to stop saying. We need to say Catholic and Christian.
Yep.
That's right. No one out there is what religion are you? Judeo-Christian. That's nothing.
No.
Right. Or the West. I believe in the West. No one is going to shed blood for the West. They will shed blood for Christ and the church.
Yeah.
So we need to get away from saying the West and Judeo-Christian. We need to start saying, I think we need to start saying Catholic. We need to start saying Christian. We need what made the world so great? Not the West or Western values. Catholicism. Let's just say it. So I think we need to do that to kind of preserve and to build what's happening and point especially young eyes to what was the glory of Catholicism.
Absolutely. 100%. I think that's a great way to end our interview today.
It's Catholicism that built the West. So
that's right.
The West has any significance at all.
All right. Well, Dr. Marshall, we thank you again for discussing these very important topics with us. We congratulate you on the book's release and its wide and growing audience and the many conversations and controversies that it has kickstarted. Hopefully this is a sign of renewal from within the church and the wider culture, that so many people are thirsty for this topic and these conversations. Continue to pray the rosary and stay faithful, and pick up a copy of Infiltration on Amazon, Sophia Institute Press. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. We hope to have you again on soon. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless.
We thank you for joining us today on another special Right on Point interview.
We value your positive and constructive feedback, so please send us an email at ROP@rightonpointpodcast.com to voice your concerns and ideas about this show. You can also submit your comments on the contact page of our website, rightonpointpodcast.com.
In addition, make sure you subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. We are available on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, and many other outlets.
Find us on social media. You can follow us on Twitter at ROP Podcast, like us on Facebook at ROP Podcast, and follow us on Instagram at Right On Point Podcast to participate in exclusive polls and view other great content.
When truth-telling has become a revolutionary act, we thank you again for tuning in to the podcast that is committed to delivering it right to you.
Until next time, I'm Olivia Ingracia.
And I'm Paul Ingracia. So long and God bless.